All right, welcome to the Blacklist Sessions. This is the podcast where we talk everything music, business, and video, pretty much whatever comes up. And we have a really exciting guest today. I'm very excited to meet Dimitri. How are you going?
How are you?
Yeah, really good. Now, you're a very interesting bloke. You've done a lot of great stuff with your life. You're from Silver & Young Private Wealth, is that correct?
Yes, this is correct, yes.
Awesome. So, I understand that you were born in Egypt, is that right?
Yes, I'm Greek, born in Egypt. Four generations of Greek parents, something probably I would put it in similar to Greek Australians, if you can relate to that. I'm sure you or your listeners have some Greek Australians or Australians Greeks. So yes, we born in Cairo, four generations from both sides, and I went to a Greek school. Finished high school with a Greek curriculum. My first language is Greek. It used to be my second language, Arabic. Now is English. And the third language is Arabic.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. I have two languages myself. I can speak English and I can speak Bogan. Yeah, so you spent a lot of time over in Egypt, and I understand you went to the University of Cairo.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you moved out to Australia. So
yes.
When did you move out here?
I moved 30 years ago when I was 29, close to 30. Already I was married. I had three children, Alex, Angelo and Katerina. And of course, we came here to Australia as a whole family. I came 6 months before my family, just to establish a little bit myself, find a job, rent a place. And then 6 months later, my wife Irene and the kids followed me.
Awesome. So what do you think were some of the biggest challenges of migrating from Egypt and then coming to Australia?
The biggest challenge is, of course, is the language barrier, because I knew a little bit of English, but probably could read and write not in a bad level, but I could not really speak very well. Plus the accent, the Aussie accent was a bit different what we taught at school. So for the first 5 years, I probably haven't read a Greek book or listened to a Greek radio or a Greek newspaper, only English, because I realized that if I don't get the language just in a level that I couldn't communicate effectively, there is no chance for me to assimilate and make a life in Australia. So first problem was the language. The second thing is that when you migrate, you lose everything really you have. A little bit of your culture, your family, your friends, everything is new. Your driving license has to be renewed. Everything is different, and it's a bit of shock on the system. Of course, we knew that, and we accepted that. And when you leave your environment that you're very comfortable, of course, you understand it's going to happen, all this. But more or less, it's still shocking the system.
Definitely. Well, yeah, there's a lot of different challenges that people wouldn't even consider. Like the driving license thing, I would have just figured, oh, you know, it'll be fine. But yeah, you have to go through the whole process and everything. So that's really interesting to hear. So You haven't always been in private wealth, though.
No. You know, when you come from overseas, you need and you have a qualification. I had a bachelor degree in veterinary science, and I practiced there as a veterinarian for 5 years, specializing in chicken farms. So when you come here, I came as a migrant with the thinking that I will qualify my degree and I practice here as a vet. This didn't happen for many reasons. There's no reason now to be negative or and do anything more than move on. And so in the first 3-4 years, it was just trying to adjust to that, to get my degree back, my education, to where I was. Then I realized I couldn't. So the second part of my list was something to do with finance. So I always wanted to be a vet. First one, I want to be an archaeologist. Because I'm a bit dyslexic, I didn't go there. Then I became a vet, which I really enjoyed. And the third on the list was something to do with finance. So I said, let me try this. And destiny sometimes works in a mysterious way. we opened a newspaper in, I think, Sydney Morning Herald. My wife found a conversion course in Macquarie University. If you have a degree, you convert your degree by doing another degree. So that's what I did. I applied to Macquarie University and graduate diploma in accounting. And a few years later, I was a qualified accountant.
Awesome. So that's it's a really interesting transition going from veterinary science over to accounting and financial planning. So do you think there are any skills from what you learned in veterinary science that translated over to finance, or was it just completely different?
No. I think there are a lot of skills. Plus, there is always you learn your skills from your family setup, from your environment, for what experiences you have. And this is you always ready to apply to your new profession or to your need, your new need. And I give you an example. I mean, my kids always worked in, say, from 14, 15 years old, say, to McDonald's and to different hospitality area. Mm-hmm. They applied these skills when they are in the professions. The same to me, as a vet, you have to analyze, to take a history, not to be pre-assessed before you have the clues, what is the reason of the disease and what then you need to do. The same applies with accounting, the same applies with financial planning. You still have to take the case to see, okay, you come to me for a financial planning advice, where you are, what you want, it is really that what you want, is really where you are better off, you are worse off, and then do a case and then treat the case. So it's a very, very similar stuff. It's just different applications.
Yeah, definitely. It's very interesting to look at it that way and think, well, you know, you take a really holistic approach and take it from that sort of perspective. It's really interesting. So you've gone into private wealth, but the first thing you did was accounting. So what was the transition process like between accounting and financial planning? For those that aren't too familiar, what are some of the similarities between the two, and what are some of the differences?
Accounting is probably a discipline that is reactive. And what I'm saying reactive, you need to lodge your tax returns. So you need to do financial statements for your company, your trust, your family trust, or your partnership. And so it's always a little bit reactive. And then, of course, you want to go to a business, and you go to business, and you ask with your partner, for example, and you are going to conquer the world. And so, which way? Because we don't want to pay too much tax, so we do it as a sole trader, as a individual, as a, you know, partnership, as a company. So the accountants work a little bit more compliance and implementing the law. Financial planning, on the other side, it is when you really want to go to the next step to create wealth, to consider your risk. Say, for example, someone in your age, say young man with a wife or a partner, one or two children, has a different risk to someone in your age who has no girlfriend, no married, and even the same job. They have different risk applies to the next 5 or 10 years. You are more vulnerable when you have little children than if you by yourself. So financial planning is a bit more of achieving your biggest goals, achieving your goals of your whole journey, not just one or two goals. It's the journey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what are some of the people that you think really could benefit from financial planning?
Look, everyone can benefit from financial planning, provided They have a bit of thinking to understand and see what they want to achieve. And unfortunately, the people who are very young, they don't think in the long term.
No, they don't.
and the people who are already close to retirement, then they get panic and they said, oh gosh, I need to do something. I'm 55 or 60 or 45 and I'm retiring in 10-15 years. What should I do? Of course, there is a solution for both cases and anything in between, but probably determine the journey and then have a step or two or three or 10 steps to achieve that journey, really.
Yeah, so it really is different for everyone, and people should start to plan earlier rather than later.
As soon as possible, it is better. I see clients that they started, say, 20 years old, and already they have a $30,000-$40,000 savings from McDonald's and Hungry Jack's and little jobs here and there. And they just, the question is, okay, how can I put my deposit for my home or for my house, my investment? These people are going to be a lot far ahead of the other people that they ask these questions. Only they found the Mrs. or Mr. Perfect 10 years later. And I said, now, okay, we want to start a family. I'm 35. When you're 25, you already have a 10 years lead. So in retirement, they're going to be a lot easier to have a conversation. Okay, darling, when I'm retiring at 60, 65 or 70. And this is only, we're talking about money. We don't talking about, I mean, people love to work. So if you ask a doctor, he never wants to retire, not because of the they make a lot of money, not at all. It is because they enjoy the interaction with their patients. But say a worker in a mining industry probably wants to retire earlier than later.
Yeah, for sure. So that's something you would take into account, like whether someone wants to retire early or they're just happy to keep going.
Absolutely. The aim of every interaction we have is to put the client in the best probably taxable position according to their needs, then of course to help them create wealth and preserve that wealth through risk mitigation. Risk mitigation is a very, very, you know, term. So through insurances, so according to their need at that stage of their life. And the third one is to help them articulate a plan that if they decide to retire 10 to 15 years earlier, they will be able. Now, if they do or don't, it's up to them. But it's not forcing because they don't have the money. It's because they just like to do what they do.
Yeah, so really at the end of the day, it's just generating financial freedom so that you have the choice to do whatever you like.
Absolutely. And financial freedom, it's a very strong proposition. The reason it's a strong proposition, because it gives you the ability to do other things according to your values. Mm. Say, for example, if your value is to save the world, hypothetically or put it very broadly, yeah, it gives you the freedom to try. If your value is, for example, to contribute to research and development for cancer, treatment for a particular cancer, it gives you the freedom to dedicate funds or to dedicate time to do that, if you have the skills, of course.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, to be able to set yourself up first, make sure that you've got your own life in order, your own finances in order, and then you can fix the world.
The people who usually they forget is that these things that don't come in one day. This is an ongoing process. You start as early as possible. You get the best team around you to advise you according to your level, of course, of finance or financial interaction. Mm-hmm. So if you are just a simple employee, you know, working and go to work 9 to 5, you don't have really complicated tax structures or, you know, tax saving scenarios compared if you are an entrepreneur or a business owner.
Definitely.
So you scale that to whatever you have. And every time you change, you scale up or you scale down. And in between, you have to be constant that investment is not one transaction, it's a constant transaction, it's multiple transactions. You buy today and you buy tomorrow and after tomorrow, and you do this and you protect your capital and you protect your income and you protect your life if you have children, for example, and you want to leave behind, and you protect your business if you are a sole operator or you are the main man of the business. So there's a lot of things you need to do constantly. But if you have the right team with you, and you have a little bit of discipline to do this stuff, it's very, very, very rewarding and a very expanding your knowledge and your ability to implement this journey that you started when you were 15 or 20.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. So the average listener of this podcast is between 20 to 30, maybe just over 30. Let's say that they're on an average income, they make about 70 grand a year, and they've got $100,000 saved up, and it's money that they can use to either buy things or they can invest. What would you suggest that the average person, let's say 25, should do with that $100,000?
Okay, first of all, we have to make a disclaimer. We cannot cannot give financial advice to anyone over a broadcast, of course, because I don't know their circumstances and I don't know their personal situations. But hypothetically, John and Margaret, they're earning $100,000. They can consider a lot of things. Number one, what they want to do. And that's what I keep coming to the word journey and goals around journey. Because if you don't know where you're going, how are you going to plan how to go there?
Very true.
So you need to determine that. Say, for example, primary residency. Some people, they have the need to own the house. I, as a migrant, my first thing, I wanted to own my house. Mm-hmm. Because if I didn't own my house, I would go back to Greece or to Egypt. Mm-hmm. The reason is I would go back to Greece is because I was middle class there. Mm-hmm. So I could always go back. The door was always open. So the first thing for me not to go back and stay here and ride the wave and travel the journey, I knew for myself I needed to buy a property. Mm-hmm. This could maybe not apply to you or to another migrant who comes from other side of the world. So you need to determine what is your very important thing. Then second part is, of course, your income. We forget that the income is the most important part of doing anything else. Mm. And then what do you do with your income? Your budget. You do something with your income. Did you spend all of them? Do you want to live today and don't worry about tomorrow? Do you want to go, for example, on a breakfast, $60 every Saturday with your girlfriend or your fiancé or your wife because you feel rewarded of the hard work? This is a choice. It's nothing wrong. And who am I to criticize anyone? Mm. But if you want financially freedom, retire 10 to 15 years earlier and create wealth, well, you need to compromise a little bit of reward today for future reward. So we need to determine that. Then you have $100,000. What do you do with this $100,000? You have to consider, should I take a small loan and do an investment property? Should I buy my own home? Should I invest for a parcel of shares, whatever, because I want to achieve something else later on? So if you don't answer these questions, really you don't know what to do. And any answer, it is not, it won't be good for the person. The reason is, it is the strategy that we usually advise, not the tools. Everything else is the tool. If you buy property, is a tool. If you buy shares, is a tool. If you buy an investment portfolio, is a tool. If you buy business, is a tool. A tool to what? To create and achieve your goal at your end of your journey and enjoy the journey also. So it's not just to achieve what you want to do. It's also enjoy the time between now and this magical 67, 80, 90, which today, 67 is an illusion because most people live up to 92. So when we say retire 67, it is really not much because you have another 30 years of productive life after that, really.
Well, but that's it. So that's, really interesting to put it that way. So the best thing would be for people to come and talk to someone like yourself and really explain their circumstances so they can get really quality advice.
Absolutely. And you don't need to take the advice and implement it 100%. The reason is maybe they're not ready to implement it. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have other things in life that they need to settle. For example, a young couple, they want to get married and the priority for them is the wedding. So beyond that point, they need to do this point first and then plan for the future. Because I see a lot of couple say, oh, look, I'm marrying in 6 months' time. So everything I save is there. Yep. Everything I do is that. So understand, but it doesn't matter really. But you put the plan and you pave the way, the path to achieve that. And it takes some time, really. It takes some time to think about. And the more the couple, if it's a couple, or the individual is determined what they want to achieve, the easier it is.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess what's some of the things that you think have really helped to grow your own business? Because you started as a migrant coming out to a brand new country. What were some of the key things that you think have helped you to grow the business to where it is today?
There is several things. So one of them is by doing multiple tasks in a different, say, by working a different discipline, say working in a factory, working in a county practice, working as a vet, working in a different areas, you learn a lot of skills and how to adapt to that skills. Secondly, I personally, and I'm not saying this is the right for everyone, I don't judge the book by its cover.
Mm-hmm.
So all the people who come to my office, I'll give the benefit that they want to benefit from my information and my knowledge and my experience, and I give 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, they really don't do anything. They don't want to do anything. They just want to have a chat.
Yep.
But some of them, they do. The other thing is that hard work and discipline, procedures,
mm-hmm.
Commitment, budgeting, your expenses, even in a business, on your personal level, not to exceed your income. So you'll be more free to invest and reinvest in your business. Very important, take advice. Because I know a little bit about this in that area, but I don't know about law. I don't know about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So take advice from people who are good what they do, not they say that they're good what they do.
Yeah.
A lot of people I've seen, they take advice from parents. Parents have the best intents. I mean, who is going to love you more than your mom?
Yeah,
there's no other person in the world is going to love you more than your mom. And if you're lucky, your dad. And probably, if they're not around, your wife and your kids. So, but a lot of times we take advice from mom or dad, but the mom and dad was not an entrepreneur as you are, or you are not as hungry financially as you are. Also, the values are different a little bit for what your mom's and dad values. Usually they're very similar, but a lot of times are not that similar.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, the economy changes so fast. Like, you go back maybe 5 years, people would have laughed at the fact that there's negative interest rates in the world. People would have thought that
Absolutely,
was crazy.
Yeah.
So I guess it makes a lot of sense to be talking to people that are doing what you want to do. Like, I tend to listen to a lot of people that are really wealthy and have a great life because I want to make sure that that's where I'm headed. So for me, it's really important to take advice from people that are professionals in the field and have a really good insight into what's going on in the world, in the field.
Another very important factor is, which I mentioned before, is to continuously invest. Continuously invest in small parcels. This gives you two, three advantages. One, by continuously invest in a small stuff that you understand, what it gives you this exposure. Gives you this exposure, and you just work with whatever you invest. If it is a parcel of shares, or if it is, I don't know, in your friend's business or your dad's business, whatever, it gives you this exposure of learning. Secondly, your mistakes, because you invest small, are small, so you can learn from your mistakes. And thirdly, because you're thinking this way, somehow the world attracts, you know, you attract this stuff to you. And when you're having a conversation in a barbecue, conversation with people who know, or even people who don't know, you just tune to this sort instead of not thinking about investing. I think only work hard and save. And the other very important, of course, for younger generation, it is they concentrate. All of us, it doesn't matter what age, we concentrate for how much we're making. And we don't concentrate too much for how much we're spending. And this is very important, because you see, the bucket of money comes in, has a big on the top, opening the money to come in. But there are little holes in the bottom of the bucket, which is your rent.
Mm-hmm.
It is your personal expenses. If you're a smoker, your cigarettes. If you have you like a beer, your beer in a pub every Saturday and Friday night. So these little holes, it takes a lot of water without thinking, a lot of resources out. So you have to think about this as well. And this is very, very important part for any wealth creation strategy.
Definitely. And I think that exactly that is what's led to Australia having the biggest debt load in the entire world. It's crazy. So what do you think is the biggest financial mistake that so many people make?
The biggest financial mistake, I believe, for many people that I came across, they want to do one big transaction and that's it. They want to buy, say, a property, or they listen to read a book and multiple properties and multiple share portfolio, and they do it all at once without having the skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, to take advice, it's good for people who know, but you need to develop the skills to evaluate this advice. You know, you can't take it because I came to your office or you came to my office and I look half decent and I wear a nice white shirt and with a tie and I look respectable. That's fine. Yep. But you need to evaluate what I say to you. You need to evaluate and understand what this advisor or this person who helps you and guides you, what he says makes sense to you. And of course, the other thing is that people do mistake is we have something we call as risk tolerance and risk appetite. And I'll give you an example. When I was younger, I liked sweets. Mm. So I could eat all the cakes, cheesecakes and pavlovas of, you know, in a barbecue. And I go at bed and I sleep like a baby. This is 30 years ago. But today, I still have the same desire if you are invited to your barbecue and I eat all the pavlova. But at night, I can't tolerate the burning stuff of my stomach of too much sugar. So my risk appetite, it is the same as was 20, 30 years ago, but my risk tolerance is different. So they need also to understand their risk tolerance and appetite. So if you don't understand your risk tolerance and appetite, you can't take risk more than you can cope. Because if you take the risk more than you can cope, then you react aggressively to anything. Say, if you put $100 on a BHP and BHP drop 20%, you feel, oh God, I'm losing $20. I'm losing my $20, so I need to do something. Maybe you need. Mm. Maybe you don't. I don't know. But you need to assess this risk before you do any investment. So I think this is one of the biggest mistakes, that people go too hard without really understanding themselves first and have the education and they have the knowledge, enough knowledge to judge, not to be experts 100%, but to judge if what they do, it is work according to their values and to the journey they want to have for their life.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess with investing, a lot of people do freak out when they see the stock balance go down minus 10, you know, minus 20%. Oh gosh, what am I going to do? But the way I approach investing for myself is, hey, if I thought it was a good deal at 100, then it sure as hell is a good deal at 80. So I often spend a lot of time averaging down on costs if I find that the fundamentals of the business are still the same. Is that something that you would advise to people?
Absolutely. This is a very good strategy, average down, if it fits the whole strategy for the person. If the fundamentals are strong, of course, average down, it's a very good strategy. And the other thing is, say, for example, we have, say, $10,000 and we want to invest it in a parcel of share. And we ear tag this $10,000. It is on a higher risk and we're going to invest it in the share market or some stocks that we believe that are very good, say the top 50 of the Australian shares. Mm-hmm. Usually it makes more sense to invest them in a parcel, say every month or every 2 months, and take it slowly, slowly. Because for example, if you bought Westpac today or yesterday was really down, 3 months ago was up, and in 3 months' time, I don't know, maybe the bad news about the bank goes away or someone's resolved, you'll be back again. So, yes, you don't take the cheapest price, but most likely you don't buy the most expensive price. And if your long term, it is, say, 3 to 5 years and longer, then this is pays a lot of benefits in the long run instead of trying to pick up the bottoms and the troughs, the bottoms and the tops. And I can tell you, very few people do it. And if they do it, everybody knows. And if they don't do it, nobody knows because they don't say it to anyone.
That's right. Yeah, it's pretty much impossible to pick the top and pick the bottom. So, yeah, I guess just averaging down seems to be a great way to go. So, is there anything on the horizon in Australia economically that you think might be a bit of a problem that might start to really filter through and affect the entire economy?
I think one of the most... of course, this is a personal opinion and... I don't have all the facts and all the information regarding wages and wages growth. I think the wages growth is an issue. Mm-hmm. The wages growth is an issue, and I can feel it from our industry. All the financial industry, there is a lot of pressure to outsource to overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, say, for example, in our practice, I need to employ Jay, for example, to be a senior or a junior accountant. But if I have a competitor in Philippines or in India or in Taiwan or in Laos or in Vietnam, which is they're very popular, with half of his wages, how is his wages going to grow? And how is going to buy more property? And how is going to buy more shares? And how is going to buy more insurances to protect his family? And how is going to do more things to their level? So to the standard of living he wants to have. So yeah, I don't have the solution. Mm. I don't know, but I find that the job growth, it is really very, very tricky with the globalization of the whole world now. I mean, my wife is an interpreter of Greek and English, and now it's very easy to get an interpreter from over the network and from the internet, Upwork, for example, and get someone to interpret a page. And then suddenly you're very much in competition with the world. Is this good? No, really, in the long run, because we upskill and we're still smart country and we're still positive and we had always this somehow. But it is really a stress factor for the economy.
Yeah, definitely. I would really love to see Australia start to innovate a lot more. I think we've lost a lot of that to overseas, and I think if that could come back, I think that could spur a lot of job growth in some industries that are quite challenging and really difficult to replicate, because there's so many incredibly smart people in Australia that have developed so many amazing things over the years. I feel if maybe the government, private enterprise spent a little bit more money on the R&D side, I think we could bring a lot of that back.
Absolutely. I have a family member in my very immediate family that he was very involved in research and development in university, in fiber optics. And they cut government after government after government after government, the last 3-4 governments. They cut the R&D dramatically and the universities cut. And so you could see the person is a doctor, a PhD, and a great researcher. He fills more files and more documents to get a grant so to continue his research and development. So what is the flow and effect to the Australian development? And at the end of the day, we don't have a chance to succeed if we're not smarter. I mean, why Australians are the best farmers in the world plus New Zealanders? Why? Because they did research and development, because they innovated, not because they worked more hours. At the end of the day, you have 24 hours. You can't compete of that. It doesn't matter how hard work you are, you can work only 24 hours. The only thing you can compete is the more intelligent you are. That's why we are the best farmers in the world, the most efficient farmers in the world. Of course, the Americans coming back, but we live far beyond other countries. Why? Because of the research and development. Why? Because of the CSRO. Because of these big research houses that we had, and we get the dividends of 20, 30 years ago of research and development in every aspect, from agricultural, for the technology, the space, participation in the space with the man walking on the moon, and so many stories, great stories. So absolutely, you're right.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's been really interesting to have you on the podcast today. It's been a lot of great insight. So before we wrapped up, I wanted to have a talk about the bees. I understand you do a bit of beekeeping.
Look, I always have a passion about many things related to animal and plants. So I have bees, yes. I have a small farm outside Sydney, about 2-3 hours. And I was trying to do something outside of the box, and I couldn't find something. And so I thought, what about bees? So it's not really outside of the box. Other people have it.
yeah, they're mostly in the box.
Yeah, usually they're in the box. So I started the bee. I have a small apiary. It produces a little bit of honey. And the great thing about bees is that I don't know. I find it very interesting. I find it very, very rewarding, and very, very. They are really the hard workers. I mean, you know, bees are really hard work. They don't stop 1 minute.
Yeah.
And it is good for the environment. It's very good for the environment. And now, when you start, you know, it's like when you buy a car. Say you buy, I don't know, a Holden, a Mazda. All the cars around you are Holden and Mazda, especially in the time before you buy. Now, I walk around my suburbs with my dog, and I see there's not enough bees in the flowers. There's no this. I notice.
Yeah.
But before a few years ago, I didn't notice. So bees is very, very, they're really under stress themselves. So yep. Always liked the subject. So I did some courses to learn more, and applied them, and it's very rewarding. And I really suggest if someone has the time and the effort, he likes to have to put the effort and the space. It's very rewarding.
Awesome. Oh, I'm glad to see that someone's looking after the bees. I think we need them. So, Dimitri, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great having you. So what's the best way for people to get in contact with you if they want to fix their situation?
The best probably way is to call Silver Young Private Wealth or 9600-7760. Ask for Dimitri or Earl. And if they mention your program, the first hour is free of charge. We don't charge anything. And just is a consultation, and we have a chat for an hour. And we tell them what to bring with them. And we take it from there.
Yeah, sweet. That sounds like a great deal. So if you mention the Blacklist Sessions with Silver and Young, get on the phone with them. I'm sure you guys are on the internet as well.
Absolutely. Silver and Young Private Wealth.
Fantastic. So that's the best way to get in contact. I'm sure if you guys get on Google, you'll definitely find Silver and Young. So Dimitri, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And thank you guys so much for listening to the podcast. This has been the Blacklist Sessions. And stay tuned. We've got a lot of really interesting guests coming up over the next few weeks. So stay tuned.